Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Democratic National Committee suing Russia, the Trump campaign, and WikiLeaks, and discuss how this might impact the Mueller investigation and bring the issue of impeachment to the forefront in this year's midterm election campaign as the central plank of the Democrats' platform. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and Lone Star Project and served as the executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, joins us to assess whether the fundraising benefits of the DNC's lawsuit will be outweighed by the negative messaging Democratic candidates in swing states will be stuck with as large numbers of hopefuls join in the primary races. We will explore the depth of the anticipated blue wave, particularly in Texas, where Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke is challenging Ted Cruz in a U.S. Senate race which could prove a tectonic upset for the Trump-dominated GOP, particularly since Cruz has written in Time magazine such fawning praise of his previously bitter rival, Trump, which has been mocked widely for its unctuous sycophancy. Then we will speak with Lawrence Jacobs, the chair of political studies at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert Humphrey School of Political Affairs. He joins us to discuss how Donald Trump is capitalizing on the imperial presidency erected by presidents since World War II, provoking dire fears that American democracy will die since our national security and foreign policy is in the hands of a unilateralist with an aberrant personality and a reckless governing style. We'll assess whether a deal coming out of the Trump-Kim Jong-un summit, no matter how cosmetic, could revive Trump's presidency, or a war with Iran could give him a short-term boost before things turn sour, as they did with the Iraq War. Then finally, with students across the country demonstrating on Friday on the anniversary of the Columbine School massacre, we'll speak with Josh Koskoff, a Connecticut-based trial attorney who represented 10 Sandy Hook families in a groundbreaking case against the Remington Arms Company for marketing the Bushmaster AR-15 used in shooting 20 6- and 7-year-old schoolchildren and 6 educators in just 5 minutes. We will also discuss the lawsuit by a number of Sandy Hook families against Alex Jones of InfoWars for promoting his despicable conspiracy theories that has led to the further victimization of these families who already suffered such unspeakable losses. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
Hello, how are you? It's glad to be with you.
Well, thanks, Matt. And I've got a lot I wanted to run by you. The lawsuit from the DNC suing the Trump campaign, Russia, and WikiLeaks. Also, the triage going on with so many Democratic candidates running for these seats in the swing states. And, of course, the Beto O'Rourke-Ted Cruz race in Texas, which could be a tectonic upset, particularly following Ted Cruz's Valentine to his former rival, Donald Trump. But let's begin with the DNC lawsuit against the Russians, against the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. Obviously, it's going to do well in terms of fundraising. And I noticed that the head of the Trump campaign for 2020, Parcells, said rather snarkily that the DNC is broke. So what's going on there? Because a lot of people are concerned that the lawsuit's going to muddy the waters with the Mueller investigation.
Well, Ian, I fall into the camp of agreeing that it probably does muddy the water some and distracts Democrats and voters from the task at hand, which is to win elections in the 2018 election. And so I wish the DNC would have put it off. I understand their frustration that the DNC was violated, and there certainly appears to have been collusion between Russia, the RNC, certainly the Trump campaign, and WikiLeaks. But I think that the types of change that we so desperately need in the country are only going to come along by winning elections, not winning lawsuits. And so I wish the DNC would have waited and would instead direct its energy specifically towards beating vulnerable Republicans in 2018.
Well, I think in some ways you could make the case that rather than wait, they should have done it much earlier, right out of the gate. The good thing about a lawsuit like this, which is a civil suit, assuming somehow you get the right judge, or I don't know whether you could even get a jury on a case like this, but the long and the short of it would, from my mind, I think it's pretty clear that President Obama didn't step up at the time and alert the public. Now, he did try. He met with McConnell and Ryan and Pelosi and Harry Reid when the Russian stuff first emerged through our intelligence services. And McConnell and Ryan would not cooperate and make a joint statement that Russia was interfering. And Obama decided not to go ahead because he thought it might appear partisan and therefore muddy the waters in the election. But wouldn't it have been really useful to have come out of the gate and had forced some kind of investigation early rather than later?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think in hindsight, there's no question that it should have been acted upon immediately. And I think that President Obama does take some responsibility for that. And I think it goes to kind of what is good about President Obama, but also what sometimes was a challenge. And that is it's the notion of when they go low, we go high. Well, sometimes when they go low, you got to get down and slug it out with them. And I think this is a time in which rather than worrying about looking good or being partisan, they should have done the right thing. But I also, though, will say that that is hindsight. At the time, most of us thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and that you wanted to be in a situation where you could bring the country together after that election. So I'll give them a little bit of a pass for not acting at that time. I think now, though, that it is a distraction. And I understand the frustration of the DNC. I understand the need to do things to bring some attention so that they can raise money. But I think that we ought to be hyper-focused on making the best decisions to spend our money to win elections in 2018. If ever we've known in our history that elections matter, and at the end of the day, the story is told by the winners, it's now. And so we need to be winners in November of 2018.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Angell, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Angell has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Now, when you say that maybe Obama should have got down and wrestled in the mud a little, that's exactly what critics of Comey are saying now, that talk about muddying the waters. They say that he should be not wrestling in the mud with Donald Trump. And that reminds me what a Marine drill instructor once said to me, even if you wrestle a turd to the ground, you end up smelling like you know what. So what do you think of the criticism that's being leveled at Comey in regard to what you just recommended Obama should have done?
Well, I think that there are very different circumstances. I think that with President Obama, it was about protecting our country and putting us in the best position to make sure we have fair elections. And I know that he believed that Hillary Clinton would win and there would be a chance to do that. I think with James Comey, whether you agree with what he's done or not, history is not likely to be kind to him. I certainly think that he's telling the truth now. I think that his memos are revealing and further expose Donald Trump as just a horrible human being, but we knew that. I think that Mr. Comey has made some bad judgments all during the run-up to the 2018 election and probably since then as well. And so while I don't question his patriotism, I don't question that he is an honorable and honest man, I do question his judgment.
So since you were the executive director of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and we mentioned in the opening about the New York Times article on Sunday about the difficulty underway with, I guess the word would be triage, where you've got so many candidates, hopefuls, running in these Democratic primaries against vulnerable Republican incumbents that
by definition, it dilutes the situation. Now, on the other hand, a lot of the candidates, and God bless them, they're saying, wait a minute, this is our system, and everybody has a right to run, and let the voters decide. So where do you come down on that?
Well, I'm of the view that the DCCC has a hard and important job. They do have to make tough decisions. And they have a responsibility to spend their donors' money wisely. And that means that there will be some candidates that they like, that they personally like, that they believe that would be excellent members of Congress, but may not have as much chance to win as somebody else. I can remember when I was executive director of the DCCC, having to call candidates that I liked a lot personally and thought they would be excellent members of Congress and tell them that, look, we just don't see it. We don't see the data there. We don't see you getting across the line, and so we're not going to be there. And then calling some others that maybe at a personal level I didn't like them as much, but I knew that they could win. We thought they had a chance to win, and we would call them and say, we're in and we're there with you. And so it's a cold-blooded business, and it needs to be. They won't always be right. They'll make some mistakes because it's not a pure science. But they have to make tough choices based on their money. The worst thing they could do is take the money for 40 races and try to spread it over 60. If they've got money for 40, they should fund 40. If they got money for 60, they should fund 60. But trying to spread your money too thin is a mistake, and it's not they're not doing a good service to their donors and not covering that money correctly. Again, they won't always be right. Nobody's 100% correct, but they have to make the best choices that they can, and sometimes those are really, really tough.
But when you talk about money, and obviously Jess Unruh out here in California famously said, money is the mother's milk of politics, that brings up the kind of schism in the Democratic Party going from the last election, does it not? The donor class versus the grassroots sort of Bernie Sanders supporters. And how do you navigate that? Because Bernie Sanders showed that you could match, pretty substantially the kind of money that comes from the donor class, getting it in small donations from regular folks.
Well, again, I'm not the best person to talk about Bernie Sanders. My view is Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat, and at the point in which Bernie Sanders is willing to stand up and say out loud that he is a Democrat, then I think Democrats should listen to him a little bit closer than they should feel obligated to listen to him now. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of money, though, it's really not a matter of whether you're getting the money with small donors or with large donors, that you have to have enough money to tell your story. You can certainly have a fully funded campaign and spend the money badly and lose. But if you aren't funded adequately, it doesn't matter how good your candidate is. It doesn't matter how good your message is. You won't be heard. Instead of thinking about it as money, we should think about it as a megaphone, and that megaphone has to be big enough and loud enough for voters to hear you. If they're not, then you won't win. And so I think the DCCC, whether they're working to raise their money through small donors or through larger donors, the key is to spend it wisely. And the truth of the matter is that every good campaign that I've been part of has fundraising that operates at three levels. They have a vigorous grassroots small donor program. They have another program in which people can write medium-sized checks. And then they have some other people who have the financial wherewithal to write larger checks. And those are usually the healthiest campaigns, quite frankly.
But if you were in a situation with the DCCC and you had to make a choice, my understanding is, it seems logical to me, that the way to pick up House seats from the Republicans is you got to run moderate candidates, for the want of a better description, in these red states to turn them blue. And we saw that in Pennsylvania. So how do you navigate that in the sense that if you put up a real flaming liberal, for the want of a better description, in one of those swing states that a Republican incumbent has held, you're not likely to get elected. But if you have somebody that's more centrist Democrat, you're much more likely. That seems logical to me. So I don't understand why the party can't figure this out and have more moderate or centrist Democrats run in red states that they could flip, and then liberals in more safer districts, although maybe they've already got incumbents in those districts. So what's the... The two questions are, that's one question, but the second question would be, once you elect a sort of centrist, if not Republican light, as the critics would say, what do you get if the guy or woman votes with the Republicans?
Well, that is two questions, and I'll answer the first one first, and that is, it's easier said than done to say, well, I want to recruit a certain type of candidate, because people often recruit themselves. And so you have a number of districts in which people who are to the left of the district, people who are running really from the left back to the center rather than from the center out, have jumped into some of these primaries. And in some cases, that discourages a more moderate from getting in because they don't want to be in a primary in which it'll be so vicious and divisive that they'll be badly wounded coming out of primary, or they don't want to spend the money at the primary level knowing that they'll need it in the general election level. So in some cases, you've had some more moderate candidates stand down because the more liberal candidate jumped in to begin with. And then going along with that, though, if you're the DCCC, a lot of the noise about whether a candidate is centrist or moderate or whether they're liberal, they're going to look at this with a very cold eye based on polling, based on survey, based on an individual district. And if there are districts in which you can't get to a win number with a liberal candidate, you're going to find them pulling out of those districts. There are some districts in which maybe they've been behaving in a moderate way, but there's a big enough Democratic base that you can stimulate a base and get turnout high enough to win. There are many others that when you maximize the number of base voters, you're still short, and you have to build a coalition of independent voters and even some fair-minded Republicans in order to win. In those districts, you almost always need a more centrist candidate. And I think the DCCC has to look at those one by one by one. And in terms of the ability to fund in those races, it really is a matter of whether or not there is enough money in the state and within the district to go with and to complement the money that's being spent nationally.
Well, but do you think, though, that there are some surprises out there in terms of the traditional calculuses? For example, these teacher strikes in red states indicate to me that maybe the lessons have been overlearned from the last election, that Trump stealing the white working class. It would seem to me that the white working class is desperate for the right message, and these teachers in these red states are showing that they can mobilize and be politically effective.
I absolutely believe that's correct, and I think it's two things. It's not only are they showing the ability to organize and mobilize, but they're hitting on an issue that's important to every family. Every family out there thinks about, at some level, education and quality public education and value that. And I come from a red state in Texas, and even in Texas, there is a real concern that the state has failed to fund education at a basic level in order to provide kids the opportunity to realize their own potential. And that starts with making sure you've got good teachers that are treated fairly. And so I think education has become a national issue now, even though it's a state function. And I believe that particularly in red states where there's been underfunded education and where money that should have been invested into the schools instead has been either given away as tax breaks to corporations or just squandered on other things, I think that that is a real opportunity for Democrats to break through. I think there will be some surprise elections. I think there are some Republicans are sitting right now thinking they're okay who are going to lose. Now, I also think, though, that Democrats have to get our head out of just the notion of talking about or thinking that a blue wave just happens, that just disappointment or disgust or dislike for President Trump automatically means that Democrats win across the board. I think that we have to look at every race individually, look at the issues in that state and in that district, and make sure that those are working for us, and then the national environment will start to push you across the line. But many of these districts are hard, and you can't get there with just a national environment. You got to have good candidates and good campaigns.
Well, just in the last minute or so, touching on the Beto O'Rourke, Congressman Beto O'Rourke is doing very well crossing the state of Texas. He's challenging Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz made a very sycophantic Valentine to his former bitter rival, Donald Trump, at Time magazine, which has led to a lot of derision. But on the issue that you brought up, which is in these swing states, if you run on the basis of impeachment, you're going to lose. Cruz himself is seizing on that. And I'll read the latest tweet from Ted Cruz. The contrast couldn't be greater. Beto supports open borders, aggressive gun control, and impeaching the president. In contrast, like most Texans, I'm glad for policy victories under Trump, low taxes, less regulations, more jobs. And what's fun to watch is the mainstream media losing their minds. So, that, of course, fun to watch was one of the Valentines that he gave to Trump in Time magazine. So let's touch on that. You think it's a total trap for the Democrats to run on the basis of impeachment because the Republicans are already seizing on that, saying that's all the Democrats want to do. They just want to impeach this guy. It's not a positive message, you know, and the nation's going to go through years of agony for what?
I agree. Running on impeachment is a mistake. I think the prospect for impeachment is out there. People who are paying attention know that the president not only may have, but probably did commit some impeachable offense, and that the time in the elections will take care of that. Talking about it, running on it is a mistake. I think talking too much about Trump is a mistake, because I think the atmosphere itself and the actions of the Trump administration will keep him in the news in a negative way. People have, I think, started to make their judgment about Trump and that their dissatisfaction with him as president and in Trumpism generally. And so I think that Democrats will do better by running in their districts, in their states, talking about the things that are important there and themselves. And I think Ted Cruz, though, also has made a big mistake by really being just sycophantic with Donald Trump. And I think that hits Texans particularly negatively, because Texans remember that Donald Trump called Ted Cruz's wife ugly. He accused his father of being part of an assassination attempt. He called Cruz himself a liar, coined the term lying Ted. And when Texans see Ted Cruz then just so in such an unappealing way grovel to Trump, it really makes them see him as weak and somebody who is trying to manipulate them and who can't stand up for himself. And so the worst thing you can be as a Texas politician is weak. And I think that Ted Cruz is demonstrating weakness. And that's and so his negative countenance with that weak action really plays to Beto's advantage, because Beto comes across as somebody who knows his own mind, who's willing to speak the truth and say it loudly, willing to go to every corner of Texas, even the most Republican cities, and tell his story in a very positive way. And so I think the positive impact and the positive approach of Beto O'Rourke versus the dark and kind of snivelly countenance of Ted Cruz is playing very well right now. Again, Texas is a very, very tough state for any Democrat. And Ted Cruz, just because he's a Republican, has an advantage. But Beto O'Rourke has made this a race, and it's going to be fun to watch.
Well, just in closing, though, Rudy Giuliani, I think, has been brought on the Trump team because he knows Mueller. And they're already saying, we're going to wrap it up in a couple of weeks. You know, I'm going to talk to Mueller. We're old colleagues. This thing is coming to an end. I think that's a tactic. I think they basically, in a couple of weeks' time, they're going to turn around and say, Giuliani is going to turn around and say, you know, we tried. These guys are total Democratic partisans. This is a witch hunt. And that'll give Trump the excuse to shut the Mueller investigation down or to fire the Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, or whatever the combination of scenarios are. So then how do you avoid impeachment when flagrant obstruction of justice hits the headlines?
Well, I'm not saying that that the president shouldn't be impeached for impeachable offenses. I'm just saying that that's not a good campaign message right now. my sense is with Giuliani that they're not that well organized. They're not that strategic. I think they're pretty much making it up as they go along. I think the most likely announcement in 2 weeks is that Giuliani's no longer doing that job.
Another Scaramucci. Well, I thank you for joining us, Matt Engel.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We can take a brief station break and be back looking into whether American democracy will die with Trump capitalizing on the imperial presidency.
Parting of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triumph, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his latest book is Fed Tower, How Finance Wins, Who Governs, President, Public Opinion, and Manipulation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
Well, thank you for joining us, Lawrence. And with so much attention on the domestic race, groups like Indivisible and others out there, and of course the school teachers, I think, in some of these red states, we were just talking about that, are really showing the way, if you will, in terms of the hope for the Democrats to pick up the House and even the Senate. But nobody seems to be running on the foreign policy front. And is that because it's basically never been that important to the American people unless we're at war? It would seem to me that the disquiet about Donald Trump, he's about to possibly make a deal with Kim Jong-un, which, and since he doesn't care about anything, details, he just wants to look good. There's a great deal of concern that it'll be a very cosmetic deal, if that, or it may not happen, or maybe Kim himself might walk out on it. There's also concern with these hawks like Pompeo and Bolton now, close to Trump, who has obviously shown hawkish tendencies, that if for example, Israel gets into war with Iran, which is apparently a looming possibility in Syria, we may get involved as well in something like that. And of course, that would be a short-term boost for Trump before things turn sour, as they did with the Iraq war. So why is it that this is not being such an issue in this midterm?
Well, I think part of it is certainly that Americans don't see the cost of this. We don't see body bags coming home. I think the other part of it is that while you have had a significant amount of press coverage, including your station, but the Washington Post, New York Times, and others who have really started to get away from their desks and do some serious reporting on the domestic side, and obviously the Mueller investigation, the New York U.S. prosecutors are all examples of that. But when it comes to what's happening abroad, there's almost a silence in the American media. Let me give you an example. Donald Trump has substantially escalated the use of airstrikes abroad. Now, airstrikes don't involve putting troops on the ground. And we just saw this last week when he sent in a barrage of missiles into Syria. And was there a vote in Congress? No. Was there, you know, much discussion in the public arena about whether this was a good idea, and was there an opportunity for the opposition to ask some hard questions, like what's the strategy here? No. And this is part of a pattern. The pattern is that presidents are unilaterally taking us into war, or they're simply deploying American military force, as in the case of Syria. A few months ago, several Americans were killed in Niger, in Africa, and Lindsey Graham confessed on national television that he didn't even know American troops were in Niger, let alone 1,000 American troops. And that's what's happened. Congress is no longer involved. War is being conducted, and few Americans know about it. The press is preoccupied elsewhere and doesn't want to put the resources into covering these stories abroad. And meanwhile, there are civilians, thousands of civilians in other countries, innocent civilians who are being killed.
So why do you think then, I mean, has it ever been a campaign issue? Because your piece that you've written, Trump wields the imperial presidency, the legacy of bipartisan support for presidential power, which was prepared for a conference, A Republic, If We Can Keep It, that took place earlier in this month at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., You basically say that Trump is capitalizing on the imperial presidency erected by presidents since World War II, and this is provoking dire fears that American democracy will die since our national security and foreign policy is in the hands of a unilateralist with an aberrant personality and a reckless governing style.
Yeah, I think that's the thrust of it. And I think oftentimes the opposition of Donald Trump is focused on his personality and his peculiar way of making decisions. But the truth is that the imperial presidency, which has been constructed over the last six decades, is something both parties have built. And to really start to rein in this unilateral tendency of presidents simply to take the country into war or to launch surveillance, you would need to really start to ask hard questions of both political parties, because it's both Democrats and Republicans who have built this, and frankly, I don't think they're willing to do it.
Well, but in the last election, Hillary Clinton tried to paint Trump as a dangerous leader, and that he was not mentally suitable to have the nuclear launch codes, and that was a big part of her campaign. On the other hand, Trump ran as an isolationist and wanted to get out of all these wars, and ran against the Republican orthodoxy, ran against the Bush family, ran against the neocons. Of course, now he's got a neocon at his right hand.
Exactly. But that's the point, right? Here you had Donald Trump running as an isolationist who criticized Hillary Clinton as being eager to take the country into war. Donald Trump gets into office, and he's now been captured by this kind of war-making cabal that crosses both party lines. It's not a partisan issue, and it takes a little while to get your head around that, because we think of so much as really being a partisan thing where there's kind of this vast difference. On the president's use of national security powers, there's a consensus at the elite level.
Well, but this is why I wonder why it is that a case can't be made that how different this guy is from tradition. He talks, and his supporters on Fox News talk about this deep state conspiracy. But the truth of the matter is that the deep state is getting purged. There's only one adult left, as far as we can tell, General Mattis. And you've got this reckless guy with these horrible people, sycophants and hawks and hardliners surrounding him. And we know from the deliberations that led up to this latest strike that Mattis kept trying to tamp down Bolton and Trump. They wanted to bomb the hell out of Syria. And Mattis kept saying, you kill one Russian, it's all bets are off.
But Ian, let me give you a counterexample. Barack Obama came into office, and he continued and actually expanded President Bush's policy of using drones, not only in an active battlefield, Afghanistan, but he expanded their use into Pakistan, Yemen, and other countries in Africa. And if you look at that closely, what you see is that these drones were used the way to assassinate U.S. citizens who the national security apparatus wanted taken out. There was literally an assassination list. And people like Rand Paul and some Democrats were asking hard questions. Where in the Constitution does the president get to sit in judgment and decide alone about who lives and who dies?
Right, but I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that I don't think we've ever had a chief executive and a commander-in-chief and a president who is so sort of dangerously unstable, has an obsession with nuclear weapons, is entirely, ego-driven and all about his own image and takes things very personally. And you know, if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, God help us.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that Donald Trump is unlike any modern president we've had. But it's also the case that the powers he's wielding were established and legitimized by the previous Democratic and Republican presidents. And this idea of an imperial presidency, which, you know, myth has it, was kind of diffused back in the 1970s, is now roaring ahead. And so the power is in the hands of Trump, but the power was given to the president before he ever took office. And that's the part, I think, that's so important to understand. Because what I hear is from those raising critical questions and raising them in protest, whether it's Indivisible or Resistance or other groups, is almost entirely about domestic issues. And meanwhile, we are seeing an increasing war-making. And as you just said, I think it's likely to increase with this new group of advisors who are infamous for their interest in sending American military force abroad.
Well, I think just in closing, though, you also have to, I think, question the American people in a way. If the Iraq War didn't cure us of imperial presidency, I don't know what would. It's so obviously a catastrophe, and they do seem to like a little, cosmetic war. You know, we just had one.
Yeah, but where's the reporting on that?
Yeah.
I mean, the reporting tends to be, you know, from an aircraft carrier showing a missile going off. What it doesn't show you often is the fact that you've got thousands and thousands of civilians on the ground, or the fact that the use of this kind of airstrikes is actually giving a cause for recruitment for more radical groups. It's really, and it's being done solely by the White House. What happened to Congress? What happened to the judiciary stepping in and saying there is a process in the Constitution that guides when we use military force? It's been completely sidelined.
Well, Lawrence Jacobs, I thank you for joining us. I thank you for bringing up these issues.
Good to be with you again.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his latest book is Fed Tower, How Finance Wins and Who Governs, Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation. We're going to take a brief station break. We will speak with Josh Koskoff, a Connecticut-based trial attorney who represented 10 Sandy Hook families in a groundbreaking case against the Remington Arms Company.
Changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Josh Koskoff, who is a Connecticut-based trial attorney with the law firm Koskoff, Koskoff and Beder, who has won landmark verdicts in courtrooms throughout Connecticut and is currently representing 10 Sandy Hook families in a groundbreaking case against Remington Arms Company for marketing and selling the Bushmaster AR-15 used in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting that left 20 schoolchildren and 6 educators dead in just under 5 minutes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Koskoff.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Josh. And on Friday, there was a national walkout of students across the country on the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting. And it does seem that the students, starting with the students down in Florida, are keeping this issue alive. One of the most tragic things about the Sandy Hook shooting was, I recall, President Obama, who was clearly upset by what had happened, and he had tears in his eyes when he finally acknowledged that in spite of the overwhelming support across the country to do something about assault rifles and mentally ill people having access to them, the Congress wouldn't move. So this has been a long battle. You're taking a different tack by going after the arms manufacturers. And also, the Sandy Hook families are also suing Alex Jones. So it's almost difficult to know where to begin. Shall we begin with your lawsuit against Remington?
Sure, that's a great place to begin.
So go ahead and tell us where it stands, because I understand Remington's filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah, well, that's where it stands. Actually, where it stands on the legal side of things is that the Supreme Court of Connecticut currently has the case and is weighing a decision. The lower court in our state found in Remington's favor and dismissed our case, and I think was overwhelmed by the groundbreaking nature of it, and there is not a lot of law in this area for guidance. So currently the Supreme Court has it and will issue a decision at some point this year. But is currently on hold because when there is a bankruptcy, it stays all court proceedings. We expect that the bankruptcy of Remington will be resolved in a matter of weeks, actually. It was what they call a prepackaged bankruptcy, which means that all of the deal is sort of made ahead of time, and the bankruptcy court issues its approval and is making sure everything is kosher, basically.
Is there a connection, though, between your lawsuit and them going bankrupt? Was bankruptcy inevitable for them, or was the bankruptcy a tactic to avoid the damages that you might get from your lawsuit?
Well, that's an excellent question, Ian, and certainly the timing of it was specious and made it look like that it was an effort to shield themselves. But I think the reality of it is that the gun business is not doing well right now, and that is something we should all of us on this side of the issue should celebrate. It's just not a good investment. They were facing mounting debt, overextended themselves because they thought that their sales of AR-15s and other military-type weapons were just going to continue to escalate in the age of Trump, and that wasn't the case. So you have a lot of stock, and it's simply a supply and demand situation that's not favoring them. And so their creditors are saying, where's our money? And Remington doesn't have it.
Well, but this is one of the peculiar things about our country and the gun culture in this country. When you have somebody like Obama president and Wayne LaPierre and the NRA run around saying that Obama's going to take your guns away, gun sales go through the roof, particularly after mass shootings. And then when you've got Trump in the White House, a big proponent of so-called gun rights, the sales of guns go down. I mean, isn't that a little peculiar?
It is peculiar, and the NRA is very expert at pushing this narrative of the government taking people's guns, as well as the narrative of fear. And what they do is they compare that to the quote-unquote freedoms that are being they equate that to the freedom that freedoms are being taken or will be taken away from folks because they can't buy a military weapon to shoot squirrels. And so you do have this paradoxical situation where it's the fear of the weapons being taken and the fear of the freedoms being taken that results in an escalation of sales. I mean, there's a big segment of our population that fully believes that the government is going to come after them, and they better stockpile their weapons in preparation for, you know, Armageddon.
And again, I'm speaking with Josh Kosoff, who is a Connecticut-based trial attorney with the law firm Kosoff, Kosoff and Bieder, who has won landmark verdicts in courtrooms throughout Connecticut and is currently representing 10 Sandy Hook families in a groundbreaking case against the Remington Arms Company for marketing and selling the Bushmaster AR-15 used in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting that left 20 school children and 6 educators dead in just under 5 minutes. Let's touch on the Alex Jones lawsuit. Alex Jones has this InfoWars website, radio show, and TV broadcast as well. He has a fan in the Oval Office. Donald Trump has been on his program, and at one point, I'm not sure whether they got White House credentials for their reporters, but they were certainly working on that. But his most outrageous claims were that the Sandy Hook shooting was fake news, I guess, to use the du jour. And it was all completely fake, and it didn't happen. It was a giant hoax perpetrated by opponents of the Second Amendment. And, of course, he was challenged subsequently in an interview on NBC by Megyn Kelly on this issue. Now, you're not suing him directly, are you? Apparently, three of the parents of the Sandy Hook victims, Neil Heslin, Leonard Posner, and Veronique De La Rosa, are suing Alex Jones. Are you representing the rest of the families are going to join that suit?
That's currently undetermined at this time, Ian. But I certainly fully support the case against Alex Jones.
So where does that case stand? Because he's now trying to make apologies, back away from what he said. Of course, it's all on the record.
Right.
And even invited these parents to come and watch him tape his show, which I'm quite certain they won't to take up that invitation. So
they wouldn't if I was representing them.
Right. So what's the latest on the legal maneuvering here? Do you think Jones is basically in an indefensible position?
Well, I think, look, Alex Jones is clearly showing that he's a total coward. And, you know, for years and years and years, he's been perpetuating this Sandy Hook hoax myth. And although there were truthers, quote unquote, before Alex Jones, this is his calling card, the Sandy Hook case. And he's made millions directly, well, probably more indirectly, for his perpetuation that Sandy Hook was a hoax, because he's drawn so many viewers and of his material online at InfoWars and YouTube and listeners. And so he is the Sandy Hook, the ultimate kingpin of the Sandy Hook hoaxsters. And so this effort to backtrack and to make amends, and by the way, what could be better for his ratings than having a Sandy Hook parent on to debate about something that is so categorically true that only a fool would say otherwise. And of course they're not going to go on the program.
So how do the families, since you represent them, Josh, how do they feel about Alex Jones? Clearly the families that we mentioned who are suing now and more that you represent may join in. How do they feel about this? This seems like double punishment, rubbing salt in the wound, to say the least.
That is clearly an understatement. You know, I'm going to understand one thing. The families are not a monolithic entity. They all have their own sensibilities. But I think that universally, they're feeling a deep hurt and pain from not. It's not Alex Jones's words so much. It's the actions that they invoke in others. I mean, he's the leader of almost like a terrorist organization that has cells, you know, people acting on his behalf that he probably doesn't know, but are catalyzed by his words, phone calls, stalking, threats, you know, and outright just lies about the families being actors. These are very painful, extremely painful things to go through when they are trying to themselves recover and gain some semblance of stability in their own lives. I mean, understand that these were families ripped apart, and so it's not just the parents, it's also siblings and community. So they have a lot on their hands simply to regain some value, some sense of safety in their lives. And you have all these acolytes of Alex Jones out there, and it's the ones that act, and it's also the possibility of being in public and being confronted by a Jones acolyte. It's very, very scary right now for one of these family members, and it's not fair.
So this has happened. In other words, followers of Alex Jones, rather like what happened in the pizza parlor in Georgetown, where there was that claim made, the conspiracy theory. I think Jones actually was among the people who made it, that Hillary Clinton was running a child sex slavery ring out of a pizza parlor in Georgetown. On the surface, that is laughable. But nevertheless, it motivated some young guy with an assault rifle to come all the way up from North Carolina, I think it was, to shoot the place up. And mercifully, nobody was killed. So is that happening to the families of the Sandy Hook victims that you represent? Are they being accosted by followers, or you call them acolytes, of Alex Jones? This is actually happening to them in their community?
I mean, absolutely. You know, I can't claim that any individual has brought an AR-15 to confront a family member, but they've been accosted. I have a client who was running a memorial road race for her deceased sister, and it was supposed to be a joyous day of celebration, and she was accosted by an Alex Jones acolyte who screamed and demanded that it was a hoax, Sandy Hook was a hoax, and you're an actor, an actress. I mean, these things happen, and every time one of these family members goes out to the supermarket, they, you know, they risk being encountered by one of these true believers. You know, we think of it as absurd, but the vast majority of people will think of it as absurd, but it doesn't take many. But there's a robust minority of people who believe this, and the more facts to the contrary, the more they believe it to be true. It's just a human nature. So taking this lightly is a risky proposition.
Well, from what I can tell, the politics of Alex Jones and his followers, it's sort of where the loony left meets the loony right. It crosses both the left and the right, because Alex Jones produced this film called Loose Change, which was the primer for the Truther movement about 9/11. So he was involved in ginning up that conspiracy, and that's gotten a lot of traction, a lot of followers around the country. And then he moved on, I guess, from 9/11 to Sandy Hook. But since you've tried to defend the parents against crackpots like this, what have you figured out about why they think that way and why so many Americans embrace this lunacy?
I mean, I wish I could have a clever answer to that. You know, it's hard. It's hard when you recognize it as you do, Ian, as being so removed from rational thought to, I mean, we could speculate, you know, that these are people who are estranged from their communities and looking for and isolated and hateful for whatever reason. And there are just enough of them to find comfort in the like-mindedness of another small minority of people. You know, they're maybe they feel a sense of superiority by believing in something so categorically false and by being so hostile, that motivates them. You know, who knows why people are so hateful and lack the imagination to actually make something more meaningful of their lives. It's too bad that they don't put all this effort into even debating on real opinions. But that's what I don't understand. I mean, there's plenty of crackpot opinions out there that don't hurt anybody, right? Mm-hmm. But it's when they perpetuate these falsehoods and factual falsehoods that they cross the line. Why don't they get involved in, you know, spewing out hateful right-wing sentiments? You know, that doesn't necessarily hurt people. But these facts, you know, to tell grieving and shattered communities and families that what shattered them didn't happen is truly a grievous injury to and unnecessary. So that's what I don't understand.
Well, just in closing,
but I don't have the answer.
Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot because it mystifies me too. I mean, there have been famous political science books like The Paranoid Style of American Politics that have looked into this, but it does seem to be growing, the lack of critical thinking in the country and the growth of fake news and of conspiracy theories. And, of course, it's not helped the fact that the President of the United States embraces conspiracy theories. And I think it was the Washington Post documented that he's lied over 2,000 times. So the alacrity with which the leader of this country says stuff that's patently false. What do you think in the end of the day, who's going to champion truth? I mean, how can we proceed as a powerful country, the so-called leader of the free world, if there's no consensus amongst the citizens of this country about what is true and what is real?
Well, I don't think all is lost on the truth front. I mean, I think we have to keep in mind that it's a grotesque thing that's happening. It is still a minority of people who go about their day living these factual untruths. I think that what's going to change is, number one, we have to take the money out of these perpetuators of myth. So if it's no longer profitable for an Alex Jones type to go on InfoWars and online and in his radio program to spew these hateful falsehoods, then you cut out, you know, the sort of the ringleaders, and then it's harder to sort of generate this movement. And secondly, of course, it's at the ballot box, and I think that, you know, Trump, I hope, is going to prove to be a gross aberration of, as early as, you know, next election. I think once he's gone, I think it's going to be like, can you believe that Trump was president? I mean, remember those times? Mm-hmm. That's my hope.
Right.
So I remain hopeful because also there are people like you out there having sincere discussions and dialogues over real issues, and you'll always win. Alex Jones types.
That's good to know.
Okay. Thanks. I'm not coming after you.
No, I know, but I, you know, that means I can get up tomorrow morning and yeah, face the music or face the daily dose of doom from the White House. I thank you for joining us, Josh Kosoff.
Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Josh Kosoff, who's a Connecticut-based trial attorney with the law firm Kosoff, Kosoff and Bieder, who has won landmark verdicts in courtrooms throughout Connecticut and is currently representing 10 Sandy Hook families in a groundbreaking case against the Remington Arms Company for marketing and selling the Bushmaster AR-15 used in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting that left 20 schoolchildren and 6 educators dead in just under 5 minutes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm